Hello, and welcome to An Hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo. Today we're going to be talking about something that we've all got, a brain. But we're going to be discussing it in a way and manner that might be rather a new paradigm for your thinking, and I think it will be intriguing to you as well. I know how fascinating it was to me. My guest today is Lee Gerds. His book is called Limitless You, The Infinite Possibilities of a Balanced Brain. Lee, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I was so absolutely fascinated by your book from actually the very first page, primarily because there is such a story behind your accomplishment at being able to make discoveries that would have been considered science fiction even just 10 years ago. You have a background as a systems analyst, your pastoral counselor, management consultant, and vice president of solutions for Net Perceptions. You are currently the founder and CEO of Brain State Technologies, which is what we're going to be talking about today. You have been well educated in math and physics and a number of other areas. You are located in Scottsdale, Arizona. You
Right.
have offices throughout the world. You are a man that went through a major paradigm change yourself. And I would love for you to share your story as to how you made this discovery regarding the brain and how it works.
Donna, the old adage is that need is the mother of invention. And I had post-traumatic stress. And I knew after struggling with it for 9 years that, in fact, what I was experiencing, the times of the extreme night sweats, the quick and easy to anger, the inability to stand in a line in a grocery store or a movie or something, even in a restaurant, the being seated, needing my back against the wall, I knew that that wasn't me. And so I started to think about it as, what if it's just a computer network? And what if that network is just imbalanced because of the trauma that I faced, which was included a number of blows actually to the head? What if that was that simply created an imbalance in the computer network? So if I could look at it and see it, and if I could look at it and see it in a relatively in a state when I was relatively feeling good, and then look at it when I was not feeling good, I could get a differential between those two.
Mm-hmm.
And from that differential, then, I decided that I would look at times when I wasn't feeling good, but I would only look at the area that was dominant when I was feeling good. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So it's as if I'm going into a bathroom in a cold morning, although being cold in Scottsdale is about 60. Just
that's
to rub it in a little bit.
Yeah. Thanks,
Amy.
Okay.
Oh, that's awful, isn't it? But so I'm going into a cold bathroom. I have a hot shower, right? And the mirror's all steamed up. So I take my towel and I rub a spot so I could see myself. And so that's effectively what we're doing with the brain. We're trying to get it to see itself. And we're trying to get it to see itself in a way that would be clear if it was all optimized or balanced. And when we have done that and showed itself, showed the brain itself in that manner, it effectively will move towards that optimum state, just like a computer network will, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
If you can find a way to show it the optimum way to for the network to operate, it will stay in that optimum state.
This is a type of brain training, and you say this is a do no harm people will be told that when they're doing video games, when they're interacting with a computer, it's creating all kinds of new links and connections in the brain. This is a step that goes beyond what most people are consciously aware of, because it integrates directly, much like neurolinguistic programming is supposed to do, but you can even do it in a sense more effectively than that, because you're dealing directly with the brain processing itself, but with computers.
Precisely. We see it with from inside out rather than outside in.
I was intrigued with how you said in working with addicts, those especially that have been involved with methamphetamine, which we have had a member of our family that got involved with that. It is unbelievable how bad that stuff is.
Yes.
And yet, you were able to utilize this with a particular county in Arizona, and you had repeat offenders who went through the process. And after the first year, more than 85% remained substance-free. After 3 years of the participants surveyed, more than 75% were still substance-free. Now, that is a phenomenal statement, and you have gone into prisons. You've been invited to come in to work with some really hardcore offenders that may never see outside of a prison cell, and their violent behavior was altered. And you had some information about that, where most of them were not literate. Most of them had an anger issue because that's how they communicated in the environment that they chose to be a part of. And yet there was a turnaround after this training.
Now, let me explain, though, even for both of those populations that we've worked with, something that's important, and I didn't probably sufficiently describe it in the book, and that's how humbling this experience was for me. And the reason it was humbling was I don't think I could help myself from being judgmental in the past for people who were dealing with these issues.
Mm-hmm.
I just simply couldn't help myself. It's not that I wanted to lock them up and throw away the key. Not at all, but I wasn't very egalitarian either, and I was definitely judgmental in the fact that they were different from me.
Mm-hmm.
What I came to understand from this work over the last 9 years is that they are exactly like me, except, for instance, that they had an imbalance in their network that I don't have. And when we worked with them and that balance was changed, they changed totally. Those inmates that you mentioned, those inmates will get out. And without changing that balance, those inmates have a 65 to 85% likelihood of doing it again.
Mm-hmm.
And what we see now, after a year and a half, is that those inmates have not been written up for violence one time. And they were written up, all of them, at least monthly, but most of them weekly. And violence, by the way, in a medium security prison isn't making somebody else angry. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Right. It's a lot more than that.
Yeah. You're talking about some
bad stuff.
Yeah. You're talking about some serious efforts here and anger management.
I think that point is a very, very good point. And there are so many different individuals. We all are guilty of this. We all have, on some level or another, a part of ourselves that will stand back one day and say, why in the world am I doing this? I know better. Why in the world am I doing this? And sometimes it's a chemical deficiency. Sometimes there's just that wiring that maybe has gotten that hard wire positioning where it's become so ingrained as a habit that we don't know exactly how to break it. And that's what I found so fascinating. You make a comment that today, with the technology that has evolved, we've been able to see brain energy in 3,000 times the detail that we could previously access. We have gone from seeing the energy of the brain with a 10-power microscope to seeing it with a 30,000-power microscope.
Yep.
And we're going beyond that. I would love for you to talk about an individual. How about Daniel? Daniel is a young man that you have in the first part of your book. He was 17 years of age. He had a lot of issues. His family was a nice family. He didn't, you know, come up through an ugly situation per se.
Right.
But he really was having a tough time. And there's a lot of parents that are probably listening right now and say, hey, I've got one of those. Tell us what happened with Daniel.
Well, Daniel was arrested for drugs and was, in fact, and the name, of course, is fictitious.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, right. I just want to make sure you understand. But was arrested for drugs, and when they found the drugs in his vehicle, they searched his vehicle and found his notebook, and in his notebook he described basically a Columbine. He described how he could, in fact, do harm to students and teachers in school.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had an opportunity in an office to see him, and when we saw him, we saw that his brain had a huge imbalance, much greater than most, in which we would say would be a freeze response or a parasympathetic dominant response within the body. Parasympathetic and sympathetic are the stop and go of the autonomic nervous system. So I describe it as if I was from I am from the Midwest, and I used to go to carnivals as a kid. They had these little ducks that went around in this trough. If you ever, you're probably not that old, but they had these ducks, and you picked them up and got a prize from it. Well, there was a water sprout in the back of the trough that's going towards the left, and there's a water sprout in the front of the trough that's going towards the right. And so the water keeps going around, right, in this
mm-hmm.
trough and
mm-hmm.
carries the ducks with it. Well, that's almost precisely, I think, what's a good analogy for our autonomic nervous system. Some of it pulls back and some of it pushes out. Well, in his case, the pulling back was over 110% greater than the pushing out. And so he, in his interaction in the world, had a very difficult time to interact. You know, he wouldn't step out effectively. He wouldn't reach out in any way. So he's, you know, teenager, and you know how important peer pressure is there.
Oh, yes.
So he's isolated totally, and he's isolated, and he's internally in a complete bind. And so one of the reasons, one of the ways that he can let loose of this binding energy is to use drugs, and another way would be to explode, to hurt somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And that would mean that you would be pushing out with full force and hopefully getting rid of the pain that you're facing by everything being pulled in. Does that make sense?
It does, but it doesn't. If someone is listening to this, they might say, well, isn't that sort of a normal thing for a teenager to go through? But what we're talking about is the brain, the way the brain is working. And when someone is taking a substance like drugs, that also has an effect on the chemistry. So if you have portions of the brain that have not been developed in a balanced way for whatever reason, whatever kind of trauma or situation, and he, you found out later, had had some birth trauma.
Right.
That had affected him. So these things going on with the stuff that he's mixed up with creates really pretty much a messy muck.
The allopathic medicine model is one which would say that that interaction is based on chemistry. our model would say that interaction is based on function.
Mm-hmm.
The likelihood is that someday we'll find that these overlap and the truth lies in between.
Mm-hmm.
But from my standpoint, it's all about function. So when we change the function of that brain so that it no longer, and remember, we're talking about 110% difference. We're not talking about 10% or 20% difference or even 30 or 40% difference, 110%, which is a lot of difference. So if we look at a normal teenager, let's say, if there is such a thing, that's a joke, but if one would be considered that would be in the bounds of, you know, ups and downs of the teen years, that change might be 15 or 20 or 25% at times.
Mm-hmm.
The likelihood is that would, it would be at a 75 or 100% is very, very small. And if it is, that would indicate that they had reached their tipping point. It would just be too much on one side of the teeter totter, and it would go over,
mm-hmm.
and they would not be able to get it back. And because of that, they will self-medicate somehow. And one way to self-medicate is to take a substance, especially like meth, which is, which is in fact a stimulant.
Mm-hmm.
Another way to do it is in fact to build up enough adrenaline in an outburst of rage or anger.
It's really quite fascinating because I agree with you. I think it is between both worlds. I think it is the way the brain works and also the chemistry interaction because we see so many different things that can affect thinking. And the effect of narcotics on one person will have one effect on another person. It can totally destroy the brain. So every one of us is so uniquely different, which is what you bring out in the book. You cover the fact that one of the myths is that if you give people correct information, they're going to act on that information in the manner that they should. But having the right information, quoting directly from your book, doesn't make everything work out right. In fact, sometimes it goes the other way. And I think that has often been a quandary. You have a teacher with a classroom. You can have every one of the students in the classroom bright, intelligent, and yet they all work differently. How do you reach them? Some of them are more effective through visual, as others are more effective with sound, others like to touch. There are all of these different factors that are brought in there, and that's part of what you do in the work with the brain is incorporating different aspects of the sensory system. Am I correct?
Right. The more the brain reaches a balance and harmony, stability, if you will, the more plasticity it has. So the more it can move from doing one work in one sensory area versus another sensory area. And this has an effect in literally every aspect of our life.
What is the difference between sound and vision relative to the brain?
Well, the parts of the brain that are processing this information are in totally separate areas. And when we're talking about processing vision, for example, that's a huge amount of information, and it's an extremely high intensity of processing as well. And in order to do that and do it correctly, I wrote about Justin in the book. I don't know if you remember him. He had the cord wrapped around his neck at birth.
Mm-hmm.
And because the cord was wrapped around his neck, in other words, as a fetus was suffocating, basically,
right.
The brain itself says, my job is to keep the organism alive. I have to cut down on what develops. And so it doesn't develop use of extremities any because it doesn't care about that. It cares about it. I shouldn't say that. It's trying to conserve energy, and it's going from the least offensive, you know, way to do that to the to the most offensive, and the most offensive would be cutting oxygen off from itself. So it still develops, but it doesn't develop some of the areas that it doesn't feel are pertinent to keep it alive in this state. And so Justin's extremities aren't useful. They have no real connection to them, and his vision isn't either. He can't see, and he can't hear, and he can't cry even when he's born.
Mm-hmm.
But he has a saint as a mother who works with him for 23 years. Now, in doing that, she's taught him with incredible love and painstaking patience how to start moving his extremities. He can move the top of his body well, and some a little bit in terms of the bottom, his legs and his hips. But he can't see because he can't control his eyes, and she tries to give him exercises for that. It helps a little bit, but not very much. And he can hear and he can talk now. But he doesn't process language very fast. Now, when he started, but he's got problems with anger, severe problems.
Mm-hmm.
So he comes here and he starts to train his brain, and we see the balance shift immediately, and his problems with anger go away. Now we see the occipital lobes, which control the vision, and we see them become into balance. And guess what? He's able to see a mountain for the first time in his life. He's able to actually read easily for the first time in his life. He's 24.
Fabulous.
Is that about the chemistry changing? No, it's about the function changing.
About the function of the brain changing.
And that changed his ability. And so I believe that we haven't given credence to function very much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And instead, what we would really like to have, I believe, Donna, is a quick fix. So instead of coming to you for a number of sessions in therapy, we would like to just come to you and have you give us a pill and we'll go home and be fine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I understand that. That's very true.
Don't make me do any work, okay?
Right.
what we do culturally, when we grab on to that reality and that kind of thinking, what we do is we eliminate responsibility for our own well-being. We give it over to somebody else.
That's really not what we should do.
And what we're finding is, especially in our own medical system in the United States, is that that is terribly unhelpful for everybody concerned,
mm-hmm.
for the care provider as well as those who are being provided for.
Now, this brings up a point. The brain, just from the example you gave, isn't a fixed entity, which I'm just so thrilled that this information is coming out. The brain is actually able to reorganize itself, and so if someone has particular phobias or whatever, they can make a shift. It can be done. There are brainwave footprints. And when the brain is working in harmony and balance, then we're able to function well. Any of us that have ever been very exhausted know how we reach a point where the brain is just like sticky peanut butter. It just isn't going to work. We know we have to shut down, lay down, we're going to get sick, something's going to happen because we just can't function anymore.
Yeah.
And you talk about meditation, why that has been so valuable, and why that is something that serves us very, very well when we cultivate it. You also talk about how this brain training works from the inside out. What is it if someone were to come to you and say, gee, I heard about this on the Donna Sebo show, I have a child that's got a learning problem, or maybe they themselves say, I cannot concentrate to save my soul. I just cannot do it.
Mm-hmm.
Would this be something I could utilize?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what is it that people would need to know about what you do? How could they find out about it? Where would they go?
Well, you can find out about it in terms of the introduction, at least, on our website at Brain State Technologies or Brain State Tech, one word, TECH.com. And if you go to videos and introduction, you can see how I introduce it there. And you can see also Dr. Vijendra Singh. Dr. Singh is a neuroscientist and works here with us, talk about brain training and chemistry. So it's not that we disregard chemistry at all. It's just that we're trying to come at it from a different angle. And Dr. Singh is working and excited about now doing research. So we've started a nonprofit so we can do research to see exactly how the function is changing the chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And to see how, when people are taking certain kinds of psychotropic drugs, how that chemistry is changing the function. You see? So that's kind of a two-way street. And then we hope that in the relatively near future, you know, with sufficient resources in the next few years, we'll have some answers that we don't have now about how best to serve someone very quickly. And maybe part of the time it will be a view of the brain and medication, who knows. But it's a very exciting time. When we consider the fact that we have 100 billion neurons, that they have 10,000 connections each, the possibilities are staggering in your brain how a network could be created. For instance, that would be a larger network than every computer hooked to the internet on planet Earth.
Oh, wow. That's
and you have it
incredible.
And you have it in your brain, and you're probably using 3% of it. Maybe 5% if you're really lucky, but probably not. And so what if you could just increase that a little bit? Wow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Think about that.
Right. That is what I think is so valuable about your research. It will enable us on so many different levels with integrity. And that's another subject, too, because you said, can this be used negatively? And the answer is not really, because we seem to just innately respond to this, that it's just not going to work that way. But what you have done and what you are continuing to do in research can give so much hope to so many different people that right now are feeling like they're outcasts, people that want to be able to make changes in themselves for the right reasons, and it would help them to understand what they can do to make the changes that will make their lives better. Lee, this has just been a delight having you as a guest. Naomi Judd, William A. Tyler, Professor Emeritus of Material Science at Stanford, and Howard Skolnick, the Director of the Nevada Department of Corrections. All of these people have been endorsing your work. Each of them has integrated their curiosity into finding out how well it has served so many. You've had over 10,000 people that you have interacted with in research, and you've got all that documented and backing up everything that you have talked about today.
Yep.
Your website is brainstatetechnology.com, and if people wanted to know if this is something they could do for themselves, the information is right there on that website. Is that correct?
Correct.
Lee Gerdes, thank you so very much for being my guest today.
Oh, thank you, and thanks from all the publisher, and Namaste, and the people that helped me put together a book, Limitless You, too.
I wish you the best. I know that you're going to do some wonderful things with this.
Thank you.
You're welcome. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break. Don't forget, brainstatetech.com. Check it out. You know of someone that has a child with a difficulty. You know of someone that maybe wants help. This may be an answer for them. Check it out, brainstatetech.com. Limitless You is the name of the book by Lee Gerdes, G-E-R-D-E-S. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. Don't go away. We're going to be right back. Hi, this is Donna. And telephone lines are now open. If you'd like to call in and chat with me, I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Here are the telephone numbers to call into: 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Worldwide, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Remember, if you're a first-time listener, all I need from you is your first name or your initial. And then after that, let me tell you what I perceive. Of course, I'm always interested in knowing where you're calling in from. And then after I finish giving you my perceptions, you're welcome to ask me a question about anything that comes into your mind that you'd like to discuss with me. I wanted to share with you quickly a cute little statement that I came across that I thought was quite interesting. It's about the hermit who became lonely. Now, this goes back a wee bit of time, but how often do we think that maybe those who are hermits have it easy and that it would be something that would just allow you to not be bothered with too much of anything except just meditating and pretty much letting other people take care of you? Well, there was a gentleman by the name of Honorable Charles Hamilton. He was English, and this was in the 18th century. Now, he felt that he needed to landscape his estate, but for some reason, he decided that he ought to have something sort of ethereal. He wanted to have a hermit on his estate. He wanted to have a design that would incorporate an environment for a hermit. So he decided he'd have a suitable retreat built, and he managed to do it so that it was right in some gnarled roots of particular tree types, and he put out an advertisement. This is how it read. It said that the person that wanted to be a hermit, if they were going to apply for this, they needed to know that this would be provided. They'd be provided a Bible, spectacles, food and water, a mat, and a robe. However, the person that would play the role of the hermit must not cut his hair, beard, or nails, or speak to anyone for 7 years, at the end of which time he would be given £700, which was quite a bit of money at that time. Well, they interviewed a lot of different people for this positioning. Do you think this is something you might be interested in doing in our modern-day world? Well, I think the results might be the same as it was then. The man that was hired to be the hermit, he only lasted 3 weeks. The reason being, he said he got very lonely. The life of the hermit is not always what you think it would be, even if you're being provided everything that you might need. So I couldn't pass that one up. I just thought that that was really, and that's a true story. That's not made up. That's really a true story. Donna Sebo here. I also want to say thank you to those of you who are sending me stories and information. I'm so grateful for that. And I'm going to be sharing some items that have been sent to me by some of the listeners. And I want you to know, if you have a special story, if you've got a recipe that you just think is absolutely the end-all of end-all, then send it along to me. Send it to Donna at DelphiInternational.com. That's DelphiInternational.com. And whenever I'm in a position to use the material, I will. I can't promise you absolutely that I will, but I really enjoy receiving things. And I got an email from Carol, and she had copied a newspaper article, and this was something from the New York Times. And the headliner on it is "Worker Dead at Desk for 5 Days. Now, that would grab your attention, wouldn't it? Well, they said bosses of a publishing firm are trying to work out why no one noticed that one of their employees had been sitting dead at his desk for 5 days before anyone asked if he was feeling okay. This man's name was George. He was 51 years of age, and he had been employed as a proofreader at this New York firm for 30 years. What happened? He had a heart attack in this open plan office that he shared with 23 other workers. Now, he quietly passed away on a Monday, but no one noticed until Saturday morning when an office cleaner asked why he was working during the weekend. Now, his boss, whose name was Elliot, said, George was always the first guy in each morning and the last to leave at night, so no one found it unusual that he was in the same position all that time and didn't say anything. He was always absorbed in his work and kept much to himself. Now, when they did an autopsy, it revealed that he had been dead for 5 days after suffering the coronary. At the time he had the heart attack, George was proofreading manuscripts of medical textbooks when he died. So this is what the newspaper reporter said. Said, you may want to give your coworkers a nudge occasionally. The moral of this story is don't work too hard. Nobody notices anyway. And I'm laughing. It's a sad state of affairs, but can you imagine being in an environment that is so robotic that for 5 days nobody notices you? That is really amazing. And it's also a sad statement, because if someone knew you, I mean, it's almost as if the man didn't have any friends. Nobody ever asked him to lunch. Nobody ever interacted with him on breaks. Nobody did anything. He was just in his little environment and just so intense in whatever he did, isolated himself to such a degree that he became invisible to the people around him. Nobody paid any attention. 5 days. That is really something. So, again, the reporter was tongue-in-cheek, but I think he did have a good message. People are not going to pay attention. So make sure that you do realize that life is about interaction. Don't be afraid to talk to people. It's a good thing. Of course, Georgia doesn't care. He's gone on to happy hunting grounds anyway, so that's fine. But that was something I thought, gee, Carol, thanks a lot. That is really a fascinating story, and it's a true one. That's a true one. It's not made up. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 877-876-5227. And worldwide, also for the U.S., 888-815-9756 if you'd like to chat with me. Now, quickly, I do want to remind you, if you're listening and you're from the Los Angeles area, I'm going to be doing an appearance at the Conscious Life Expo. You hear a couple of runs of information during each hour that I'm on the air. And I'm going to be speaking there on Friday the 13th at 7 o'clock in the evening, and I will have a booth, 537, at the Los Angeles Expo, and I'm looking forward to meeting some of you. So come on by, say hello. We're going to have stuff from Teresa there. We're going to have stuff from Pete Smith with the Orthotebs, and I'm going to have some of my material. And, of course, I'm going to be doing many consultations while I'm there. It's just a very, very exciting event. A lot of things happening and going on, so I invite you to stop by. Also, keep in mind, locally, that we are going to be having the Northwest Women's Show here the last weekend of March, and I'm going to be participating in that. We're going to be giving you more information about that as we get closer. And also, I've got a class that I'm going to be teaching in Tacoma on April 25th. It's going to be a Saturday class, and this is going to be very interactive. It's about mind vision. Yes, it's about you developing your own intuitive processes and also working with yourself as an individual so that you can have more confidence in who you are. So there's a lot of good things coming up. And remember, if you get my newsletter or you go to my website and you review my newsletter there, you'll always be kept up to date with the things that are going on. And also Alaska, I will be up in Alaska in March. We're putting that all together, so that is going to be getting fine-tuned, and that will be coming out also in the upcoming newsletter. Donna Sebo here again, 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. Hi, this is Donna, 877-876-5227, 888-815-9756. I had meant to get some information to you yesterday regarding text messaging and mobile phone issues that have come up. Now, this is something that's fairly recent. Apparently, Alaska and California are the latest states to ban text messaging by drivers of all ages. Now, it's beyond me why someone, when they're driving, is going to try to be texting at the same time. It's sort of like trying to write down a message when you're driving, unless you're at the dead stop on the freeway. It's just not a good thing to do. And it's like trying to dial somebody, unless if you have voice dialing, then that's something different. But it's really quite interesting. Now, Alaska and California are joining Connecticut, the District of Columbia, Louisiana, Minnesota, New Jersey, and Washington State in banning texting by all drivers because there has been a tremendous concern about potential dangers. Well, I've had enough experiences, and I'm sure you have. People all of a sudden pulling out, going through stop signs, and you see them, they've got their cell phone up to their ear. Well, they passed a law making it illegal to do that in the state of Washington. It hasn't made any difference, believe me. And 9 other states, by the way, have text messaging bans that apply only to young drivers. So this is something that is going to be coming more and more into the forefront because of the technology that is advancing at such a rate. Now, they say texting while driving is a primary offense, meaning police officers can pull a violator over in Alaska, California, Connecticut, D.C., Minnesota, New Jersey. And bans in Louisiana and Washington are secondary, so motorists must be violating another traffic law in order to be stopped by police for texting. How in the world are they going to be able to tell you're texting anyway? Depending on what you've got, unless you've got something up straight in front of your face, I don't see how they'd be able to do that very easily. But maybe I'm being naive. Maybe you can educate me on this. Also, in the Journal of Experimental Psychology Applied, there has been a lot of research done on the use of mobile phones and how when people are driving and using them that it's really creating some very significant dilemmas. The researchers at the University of Utah demonstrated that talking on a mobile phone can slow down your reaction time, especially of young adult drivers, to levels seen among senior citizens, people in their 80s and 90s, who are, you know, very, very impaired as far as reflex capacity goes, and show that drivers using mobile telephones are as impaired as drivers who are legally drunk. That's a strange, interesting comparison. Also, contrary to what cell phone junkies want to believe, a hands-free device does not lessen the risk. And basically, I think what they're trying to get across is the fact that we have to pay attention to what we're doing. I've found many instances when I'm talking to people that are on cell phones, they are literally connected at their mental hip with these cell phones, and they're driving and we'll be talking, and I'll say, well, let me give you a number, and they'll say, oh, I'm driving. And I had no idea. I said, well, for heaven's sakes, well, let's wait until you stop, or call me back when you're at your destination. And they say, oh, no, I'll write too. Well, that's not a good thing, because when you are in traffic and when you're moving, even if you're going at a slow pace, unless, again, you're at a dead stop, you're not going to be able to do that all that well. And it is enough to distract your attention. You're looking down, and all it takes is a split second. That's all it takes, and you can be in a major fender bender. So there's been a lot of close calls. In fact, anymore, when I'm driving, I look to see if I can tell if someone has something up to their ear, if they've got their phones up to their ear, or if they're talking and I don't see anybody in the car with them. Then I know they're on a cell phone. So just be wise here. These are things that are important, and, hey, you want to be around for a while. You don't want to end up either being in an accident caused by someone doing that or being the cause of an accident like that. It's just not a good thing. Clutter, clutter, clutter. If you are like me, you'll find the paperwork ends up stacking up. You can straighten up an area, and before you know it, you have got these strange little piles all around you, and you go, how did that happen? It's just a fact of life, especially when you're receiving material, and like I receive books and all kinds of correspondence regarding potential interviews for the show, etc. So you are going to, whenever you're doing like what I'm doing, you're going to have all kinds of material around you. So sometimes you just have to go and purge. And what you might want to do, and I mentioned this before, is if you have magazines, stack them up, put them in a box somewhere, and then take them to a homeless shelter, whatever. If you have a lot of books that you're wanting to utilize, remember your libraries really can use them. And there may be certain organizations that would just be tickled to death to have whatever you have to offer. There's all kinds of charitable groups. You can donate your books there. Use it as a tax write-off. And there's also a couple of websites. If you like to swap books with other readers, you can go, if you've got paperbacks, you can go to paperbackswap.com or bookmooch.com, bookmooch.com. And you can send in your old books in exchange for other books you haven't read yet. And Beverly Sills, a very famous opera singer and the woman that worked with the Metropolitan Opera for so many years, she was such a great lady. When she was traveling all over the place, she said often the only way she could afford books when she was younger was to go to secondhand bookstores, and then she'd do the swapping. So this is another way of being able to do what she did and be able to read all kinds of interesting material. CDs and DVDs, hey, if you've got a stack of those, who doesn't today? You may want to take them out of their bulky packaging and store them in a binder. You can get those binders for $5 or less. Tuck them into the plastic sheets and then store the binder on a shelf. It takes away a lot of the clutter, saves a lot of space, and it protects your CDs and DVDs from scratches. You can always find one when you want to. Just flip through the pages like you would a photo album. Well, that's just a few tips. Oh, one last one about your CDs and DVDs. This I just love. You can help homeless animals by donating them to discsfordogs.org. Discsfordogs.org. They'll sell them, and 100% of the proceeds will be donated to the Erie County SPCA in New York, and they'll even reimburse you for shipping. So you don't have to pay a thing. Isn't that wonderful? What a great idea. Well, this is Donna Sebo. We're out of time. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking to Vaishali. We're going to be talking about wisdom. You are what you love. She's going to be my guest for a little bit of time tomorrow afternoon. So remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Wherever you are, know that there are so many opportunities for you to do better with your life. You're the one that can reach for it. You're the one that can make things happen. There's no limit to your capabilities or your imagination and talent. We'll be talking with you right here, same time, same place, right here on BBSRadio.com. This is Donna Sebo. Bye for now.